The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Tom Lombardo is the executive director of the Center for Future Consciousness and the author of Science Fiction, The Evolutionary Mythology of the Future. In this episode, we discuss cosmic consciousness, social change, and, of course, science fiction. The music you're listening to right now is an 8-bit version of the theme from Rick and Morty. But in just a moment, you'll be hearing about the myth of science fiction. Tom Lombardo is the executive director of the Center for Future Consciousness and a professor emeritus at Rio Salado College. He is also the author of Science Fiction, The Evolutionary Mythology of the Future, which came out from Changemakers Books in November. And Changemakers is an imprint of John Hunt Publishing, just like Zero Books. So welcome aboard, Tom, and I'm glad to have you on the podcast.
Yes. Hello, Doug. I'm happy to be here. And I see you have Lenin Lives and Bash Bash behind you. Interesting collection of books on display. You can't see my books because I guess you see my dragon cabinet. Bash Bash. Oh, okay. That's yours. All right. Yes.
That's my novel. Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm really interested to talk to you because, along with being the publisher, the publishing manager for Zero Books and a podcaster and all of that, I'm also a science fiction writer. I've written 3 novels and have a couple short story collections. My last novel, which was called After the Saucers Landed, was nominated for a Philip K. Dick Award.
I'm an immense fan of Philip K. Dick. In fact, Philip K. Dick will have a huge chunk in volume 4 of the science fiction series. The science fiction book is actually a series, and what you have is only volume 1, and that only runs up until the end of the 19th century. Philip K. Dick flourishes in the late 50s, 60s, 70s, into the 80s, and so he will be highlighted author come that. And I have read Philip K. Dick for 50 years now. A friend of mine told me, once warned me not to read too much Dick at one time because it'll drive you crazy.
Am I right in thinking that you're a futurist, a professional futurist?
Yes, Doug, I'm a professional futurist. I'm a self-taught professional futurist. My education was actually in psychology and philosophy and the history of science. And back about 25 years ago, I was asked to create an integrative course at the college I was teaching at. And I came up with the idea of doing an integrative course on the future. And I had been an avid reader of science fiction since when I was a kid. And I also had been interested in theories about time and evolution. And I thought the future would be a great topic for an integrative course. So I started to teach it to myself. And I started to just read the literature on it. So over the last 25 years, I've become a professional futurist. I'm actually an executive board member of the World Future Study Federation, which is the global organization of futurists, and I'm a fellow of that organization too. So I go to futurist conventions, and I've been doing that for like 20 years now, and teaching it, and also I've been teaching science fiction for just about as long as well.
Okay, you said you were self-taught. If you wanted to be an academic futurist, I mean, you're an academic and a futurist, but if you wanted to not be self-taught, if you wanted to get an academic degree in futurism, what department would that be in?
Well, actually, you would go to certain universities that do have graduate degrees in future studies, like the University of Houston, the University of Hawaii. There's a school in Virginia as well. There's a couple in China. There's a new one emerging in Saudi Arabia, actually. So there are a number of different colleges, universities around the globe that offer master's level or even a PhD level degree in future studies. You could take individual courses lots of places, and it could be under different departments, but there are definitely places where you can go and take a complete, you know, curriculum, graduate curriculum in it.
Now, if I were to go and get a degree at the graduate level in future studies, what department would future studies be associated with, or would it just have its own separate department?
Oh, it would be standalone. They are standalone departments. They probably are lumped under social sciences if they're anywhere, but they can't be independent and standalone.
Okay, so it wouldn't be under political science. It wouldn't be just part of the science department. It would be a social science.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah. Actually, Doug, the one at the University of Hawaii is under the political science department, but it's a separate integrated program. Mm. See, so because future studies is kind of an odd creature, people tend to put it different places within the academic structure of a university. But they do, lots of places do have distinctive degrees in future studies.
And so, okay, now I'm going to, really be stupid, I think, maybe, but or ask a question that might seem more skeptical than I mean for it to be, or one of those two things. But given that the future hasn't happened yet, how do you study it?
You study it in a lot of different kinds of ways.
Okay.
And they have, futurists have thought about this question for a long time. But actually, the significant figure in the emergence of future studies was also the significant figure in the emergence of modern science fiction, H.G. Wells. And H.G. Wells wrote both books on the future, or the study of the future, as well as science fiction. So how do you study something that hasn't happened yet? You study it by looking at all the different types of predictions that people make and how they make them about the future. What would be informed predictions? You look at current trends, you look at history, you look at ways in which you can as rationally as possible thoughtfully think out the highest probabilities of different things occurring. You also get into discussions about what would be preferable futures and people's visions of what would be desirable in the future. So you could study utopian thinking within future studies too, different utopias. Say, for example, if you went to the Millennium Project website, which is a very well-developed futurist organization, which is global, the way they come at it is that they have a number, maybe about 100 people scattered about the globe who monitor current trends, pull the data, pull the information in a form of collective intelligence, and make a set of general assessments of the state of the future, like where we're heading. If you don't mind me continuing just for a second, Evan Toffler, who I'm sure you know, who wrote Future Shock, he said at one point that everyone is a futurist, in that everyone thinks about the future and everyone has desires and goals and hopes and fears and has their opinions on it. So learning how to be a futurist means finding a way to systematically take what is a human tendency that we all have and that we all think about the future and try to make it into as rational, methodical as a way as possible. And look at what everybody else has written about it. Look at what they have said. Look what H.G. Wells wrote about it. He wrote a lot about it. And not just as fiction. Yeah.
So would you say that one of the things you might study in a future studies department would be the history of the future? In other words, the way in which people have thought about the future in the past?
Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly. Yes. In fact, you hit on a double whammy there, because first of all, I would say that it's very important to study history per se in order to be a thoughtful futurist, because you have to have a look at the way things have moved along through time, and then based on that, how you could extrapolate out. But secondly, it's important to look at the way people have thought about the future before and how that has changed. Everybody has heard the expression, the future ain't what it used to be. Now, the thing is, Dan Simmons, who's a great science fiction writer who wrote Hyperion, which you may be aware of, the Hyperion series. Once I got to listen to Dan Simmons talk, and I chatted with him afterwards, and he said to me, the future ain't what it used to be, and it never was. So I had to think about that for a moment, and it hit me. What he meant by it was that whatever we might think the future holds for us at a given point in time, we'll change our minds about it 20, 30 years later. The future has always never been what it used to be. So you could look at all of the different visions people have had and see how those visions actually change over time.
Although I think this is, I want to jump in and say, I think that what Dan Simmons is saying is really true, probably starting from the, let's say, I'm going to go way back and say like the 15th century in England, or starting from, to be less obscure or maybe more, you know, fully developed, starting from the French Revolution on, that like once you're into modernity, then the future is not what it used to be and never was. But before that point, if you go back into the medieval period, say, or you talk about other parts of the world, it could be that the future has always been what it used to be, and what used to be is what the future is, and you know that there's a much more of a conservation of the present in before modernity.
Yeah. Okay. The argument being there that our ideas about the future going back sufficiently far in time did not change or transform very much, because perhaps we didn't think about it as much. And so with the acceleration of change with the beginning of modernity, our visions of the future change a lot faster than they did, say, prior to the 16th, 17th centuries. But we did have visions of the future, and we had different kinds of ones back early on. I will always mention, I got into an argument with Dan Simmons when I was talking with him about when did the idea of progress emerge in the West. And Dan Simmons took the position that's the accepted traditional position, that it emerged in the 18th century, maybe the 17th century. And I come back with, no, you could take it all the way back to St. Augustine. And if you look at City of God, the idea of progress is in there. In fact, you can even push it back further to Zoroaster. So people did have ideas about a different future, different than the present, way, way back, even though they may have had, generally speaking, a more stable notion of what the future would be like, and it wouldn't be much different than the present. But of course, you got to remember, too, that most people, at least in the West, thought that the future was going to heaven or hell. That was their future after they left the earth, after they died.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's two different kinds of future. There's the future, there's the spiritual future, right?
Right, right.
And then there's the earthly secular future.
Right.
And the interest in the secular future might have started post-Enlightenment more. And the expectation that the future is going to be a product, basically going to be seen on Earth as a social or societal change, rather than as a divine intervention.
Yeah, and that's a good point, Doug, that the concept of the future with the emergence of the Enlightenment changed from something being orchestrated from above to something we were responsible for doing ourselves. If the future was going to be different, it was up to humanity to make it different. We self-empowered ourselves when we got the idea that we could manipulate nature through science and through having different kinds of governments, et cetera.
Right. So this brings me to the first question that I sent you, because I sent you some questions ahead of time.
Yes.
Now,
right.
In your book, when you approach science fiction, which is, I think, can be considered to be, although maybe it isn't always, but can be considered to be the literature of the future, about the future.
Yeah. Right.
When you approach science fiction, you approach it in terms of myth.
Right.
In the 19th century, science fiction stories were called scientific romances, which I think harkens back to the romances of the medieval era or medieval romances, which were tales of heroism and love. And an example of a romantic hero would be like King Arthur. Why do you think that modern literature celebrating technology and the advance of reason and the future began as romances?
Okay. When I hear the word romance, of course you could identify it with a certain type of literature, the heroic quest or tales of chivalry that derive back from an earlier period of literature. But I also hear with the term romance its association or connection with the Romantic era of the late 18th into the 19th century. And when I think of science fiction, both early on and then even up to today, the reason why we could say that you could call it scientific romances is because it combines together ideas about science and rational empirical thinking with adventure that highlights emotion and challenge and has those romantic qualities to it. So that when we look at, say, Jules Verne, or we look at even Frankenstein or The Sandman by Hoffman or The Mummy, the early stuff that was made in the 19th century, and even H.G. Wells too a little bit later, it has that combination in it, that synthesis of the Apollonian, of the rational, the scientific, the technological, with the romantic, which is adventure, emotion, and quests and challenges. It stimulates the affective, emotional dimension of us and takes us on an adventure. And so in that sense, it's scientific romances. It's romances about things that are informed by science.
I want to ask you about the because you referenced the Romantic era or Romantic movement, which was a 19th century movement. And when I think of the Romantic movement, I'm not that well-versed in all of it, but I think first and foremost of William Blake. And his beautiful watercolors, and he was very much a critic of the kind of rationalistic Enlightenment sort of thinking that we might associate with the genre of science fiction. But the genre was infused with the romantic ideology, at least in part, at its inception. There must have been, in a way, either a need to turn back to value systems that predated the Enlightenment, maybe something like a spiritual or romantic or religious value system in order to come up with a character who would represent values and go off and on an adventure to, represent those values, or some other need to critique the Enlightenment and rationality that was arising when people were writing early science fiction.
Oh, yes. In fact, we could use the example of Frankenstein. We could also use the example of The Last Man by Grainville, which are very apprehensive and skeptical about where science and technology will lead us. Those two novels written almost at the same time, early in the 19th century, are both romantically informed in that they highlight the emotional, personal dimension of the characters, and they have a lot of trauma and pathos in them, and they're apprehensive about science in technology, modern science and technology, and where it's going to lead. And the common view of romanticism, you use the example of William Blake, is that romanticism was antagonistic against, in its philosophy, the potentials of rational, industrial, technological, scientifically informed thinking. Yeah, all that's true, except for the fact that there were lots of scientists and poets and romantic figures who embraced science at the same time. I mentioned in the book and spend a lot of time talking about him, Holmes, The Age of Wonder, where Holmes talks about those scientists who are very romantic in their sensitivities and sensibilities, like Davy and Herschel, and those romantic writers who are very pro-science, like Percy Shelley and Coleridge. Yes, these are opposite ends in a way, but when you fuse them together, you get something very different and unique here. You get science fiction. You get romance and rationality mixed together, and you get as you know, Frankenstein is often identified as the first modern science fiction novel. Yes, I responded to that by saying that, in a sense, Frankenstein is anti-science fiction because she's crazy apprehensive over any possibilities with respect to advancing science and technology. And Frankenstein, he is a depressive, egocentric maniac who, once he sees his creation, runs away from it. Now, is this a message of that science and technology is going to lead to some wondrous realities? It's a reaction of extreme fear to science and technology in the novel Frankenstein.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Mary Shelley was the daughter of a socialist.
Goodwin and Mary Wollstonecraft.
They were very much embracing kind of a scientific sort of socialism, yes, but a utopian socialism where, yes, you could, yes, rationally organize society to harmonize class relationships and overcome oppression. Right. And she was their daughter, and she came out,
right,
of that. I don't know her biography that well, but I don't think she was, turning against the values of her parents so much as just sort of engaging with them through her work.
Been engaging with them, but the novel is very critical philosophically of using science or technology to advance and transform the human condition. I would also say that it could be another way of describing it would be, don't play God, don't mess with nature. There's those kinds of messages.
Right, sure, absolutely. But I'm going to refer to my own book. I'm no Mary Shelley, but when I wrote Bash Bash Revolution, the purpose of writing it was actually to think through what would be required to overcome capitalism.
Okay.
And I thought about using a computer singularity, an AI that would take charge of organizing society for us.
Yes.
And how that would come about. And I thought, well, maybe he could use augmented reality, the computer could use, augmented reality to redirect human beings and reshape society. And I wrote this book, and it was from a kid's point of view, and every single reader thought that what I was doing was warning against the coming singularity and warning against that sort of, and in a sense I was, because it came across as a dystopian novel. But on the other hand, the options laid out in the book are nuclear Armageddon under Trump and or the loss of what we understand to be our humanity through the singularity.
Yeah.
And so it's not as – I actually intellectually would be on the side of of the singularity here. But I wrote it, I had to write it from the point of view of a character who saw all of what was happening as a loss of his girlfriend, for one thing, but also a loss of his just sense of himself and the world that he was thinking he was growing up into. And it's basically as a failing, like a coming of age story that never got completed, because rather than coming of age, the age disappeared.
What was he afraid of, what was he going to lose now? A loss. You said the girlfriend and everything.
Like
that
a life,
he was,
like, you know, he didn't bother to finish high school, even though he was an A student, because he didn't see this much of a future. Right. So like the threats of nuclear war, and also just the overall the feeling like the future was dropping away. He didn't have any real prospects. He would just be going through the motions. Right. And then when the AI came to the rescue and reshaped society, everything he had been trained to be, everything that all of his desires were dashed, because the way he conceived of the world and his place in it was no longer relevant.
Yes, right.
So he experienced the salvation of humanity as a loss.
Right, yes.
And the same thing might be true with Frankenstein, in a sense, in that, you know, you're warning of a risk, and you're kind of telling the reader about the dangers of the coming technological changes and the social changes that are coming as well. That's there sort of as well. Without, you know, in the simple story, on the surface level, it's a dystopia, or it's a horror story. But at the same time, the values in it are being brought forward and examined as well. So, like, everyone read my novel as a dystopian novel. But I would say that just one level down, it's like, yeah, all we ever have, my message was, all we ever have are different versions of dystopia, and let's get a better dystopia. anyway, so.
You know that a lot of contemporary cinematic science fiction has been very apprehensive, fearful about advanced technologies, in particular intelligent technologies, or if not the word, use the word singularity, of intelligent robots or super intelligent computers. I take that all as being an ongoing evolution of the apprehension that was there in Shelley's Frankenstein 200 years ago. I don't want to put thoughts in your head, but you must be aware, I mean, I'm aware, that there is an awful lot of dark, bleak, pessimistic thinking today about the future. All right. Now, yeah, it's there, you know, and it sometimes is associated with technology. Paradoxically, sometimes technology is associated with a great future, both at the same time, depending on who you read and who you talk to. To the vision of a positive future through science and technology is the vision of the Enlightenment, and it is in fact the vision of Jules Verne. It is the vision to a great degree of H.G. Wells and other science fiction writers as well. There are those science fiction writers who, and especially in the movies, will play up the negative scenarios and think that what's happening here is terrible. It's just leading us, you know, into a bad situation. But the singularity doesn't necessarily have to be a bad reality for the future. You can see it that way. It depends on how it plays out, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Yeah. What I'm trying to move towards here is the difference between this sort of Enlightenment view of the future based on our rational understanding and our mastery of the world through technology, and our mastery of ourselves, maybe through social technologies. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, would be part of the socialist vision, which I share with Mary Shelley, I hope, or certainly with their parents. But there's another vision, which is a vision of Blake, which I feel like has something to do with your notion of the cosmic and the way you attach the cosmic to science fiction, which I can't deny is there. So I'm just wondering what you feel this notion of the cosmic is, and is that notion something that maybe connects the science fiction to mythic stories or other genres that aren't in the modern world, that this is the way that science fiction is a trans-historical genre?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. A couple things on that. Science fiction takes us beyond the immediate here and now, what was accepted as normal reality, and it stretches, expands our consciousness both in space and in time. It allows for transcendence. And that is a sense in which I mean that it is cosmic. We see ourselves not in the context of our little neighborhood, but we see ourselves, like Spinoza said, in the context of eternity or the context of evolution, the big picture of things. And that's a fundamental identity, not identity, similarity that it has with myth. Ancient myths, because ancient myths were often cosmic, big picture thinking. Yeah, so that's an important essential sense in which science fiction is cosmic. Some writers are more cosmic than other writers. They go out further in space and time. They create bigger pictures. But to some degree or another, they all will stretch the boundaries of the here and now. You probably have been at some point watching, since it's pretty popular. I shouldn't assume you've been watching it, but I'll bring it up anyway. The Expanse on Amazon Prime, which is a really good cosmic and very well done, I think, science fiction series. I particularly like writers like Olaf Stapleton and older writer and Greg Egan more recently, who are also very cosmic, big picture thinking. Yeah. So that's the sense in which I use the word cosmic in science fiction. Expanding one's consciousness to see oneself in the context of the universe, the vast future, the vast past, the vastness of galaxies, and the whole big picture of things.
Would you say that the cosmic is related to, or might be another word for, what in philosophy we would call the universal?
Yeah. In fact, science fiction does it better, because in science fiction, we're being informed by the imagination of writers who are in tune with contemporary science. So not that you can't do that as a philosopher, but science fiction writers will make an effort to assimilate big picture thinking in science and then create stories out of it. So definitely.
But the thing about the cosmic is that you can, in a way, at least could lead to going beyond strictly kind of empirical scientific observation.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yes. Right.
Because in order to contextualize the empirical, the immediate, the sensuous, you already kind of have a cosmic vision in mind. I mean, that's one of the observations of Marx, I think, in a weird way, or Hegel, maybe, before him, is that you, in order to have a contingent view, in order to have a sensuous experience, you have to already have some sort of value system, some sort of worldview, some sort of overall system of thought that you're putting your contingent experience into in order to make sense of it, right? And the thing about science fiction is that it deals in questions around these universal problems rather than only the contingent problems. So like a literature of the contingent or the practical or the immediate might be a small romance between a few romance and like not in the term way we were talking about it before, but like a romance story or like a one of these psychological novels that are campus novels or even just a realist novel, a literary realist novel, might stay within the realm of the practical and the sensuous and the temporally present. Whereas the science fiction novel is saying, we don't quite have enough of an understanding of the universal. We need to situate ourselves towards the cosmic in order to better understand it. And that's the kind of the quest that the romantic hero might be going on. It's certainly like in the case of Philip K. Dick, you have these characters who suddenly discover that what they think is bedrock reality, the concepts that they need, is not satisfactory at all, and that they have to reexamine what the universal is.
Yeah, Philip K. Dick said that he questioned everything about what we took as our normal notions of reality. Thinking as a philosopher and a science fiction writer here, and I even think, I think of Hegel and Spinoza in this regard, is that within science fiction, I can contextualize the immediate here and now, the me of the moment, within the context of the big picture, and consequently, I see this much better. I'm actually able to see the immediate present better by putting it in the big framework. And that's something that science fiction does. Philip K. Dick does it by questioning all of our basic ontological premises in his stories. And so all of a sudden, you know, the world isn't what it really appears to be. And that's enlightenment. And that's what science fiction will do. It'll give you enlightenment in that respect. Science fiction definitely has that power. Oh, I know what I was going to say. Arthur C. Clarke once commented that science fiction is not escaping from reality, but actually coming at reality more deeply than anybody else does. And in the sense I'm going to look really down to the fundamentals, and then the world appears in a new light. It has that power. Science fiction has that power.
Right. But when it has that power, does it have to break with that kind of sword and sorcery adventure genre that it's halfway embraced at its inception? Or where do you find that kind of science fiction, the science fiction that is the literature of ideas? And does it emerge mostly in the 19th century with Olaf Stapleton, or where would you, can you distinguish between the two kinds of science fiction?
Yeah, there's lots of different kinds of science fiction. It's different kinds of writers. I mentioned Olaf Stapleton, who's very cosmic, who was informed by evolution, theory of evolution significantly. And I also mentioned Greg Egan, who's informed by contemporary physics and computer science. Another one I can mention who's very cosmic is Stephen Baxter, who is informed by quantum theory and time travel and physics and lots of in cosmology. There can be hard science fiction, and there could be more soft science fiction too, which can get cosmic. One of the problems people have had with science fiction is try to come up with one way to limit it, and then I stick my neck out and say it's all mythology of the future, which of course it isn't all mythology of the future, because it's more than just about the future. But there's many, many different kinds of writers, it isn't necessarily older writers. There's the older ones. Doc Smith, who wrote cosmic space operas. That's a different kind of science fiction than Olaf Stapleton, who wrote philosophical cosmic adventures. And there was Clark Ashton Smith and H.P. Lovecraft, who threw the horror into the whole thing. You mentioned Philip K. Dick. And moving more up to the present, J.G. Ballard.
Yeah, he's one of my favorites.
Wrote a different kind of cosmic science fiction, and definitely like J.G. Ballard.
Ballard is kind of associated with the New Wave, I think. And the thing about the New Wave is they were these, I guess I think of them as hippies, but, you know, 60s radicals that were questioning the kind of science fiction that would have seemed cosmic in the 1950s, the science fiction that was optimistic and that was reaching out into space. And the New Wave authors came along and said, hey, there's another set of values that are being ignored here. And they're very pessimistic because they saw sort of the engines of modernity crushing humanity under its wheels.
Well, yes, but the New Wave emerged right with the hippie revolution and the hippie culture, and the two actually has similarities of values. And so we can critique the modern industrial, techno, impersonal reality of the early 20th century, which the hippies did, or the middle 20th century, and the New Wave authors did too. The New Wave authors brought in a lot more psychology, sociology, ethics. They brought sex into the picture, which were humanistic themes, which the earlier writers had not brought in so much. And Ballard brought in lots of disasters. This isn't going to come out the way you hope it's going to come out.
What? How do you view the role of myth in literature and maybe in terms of shaping the future?
Yeah, the human mind resonates to the narrative or the story. The best way to inspire a person is through a moving story, narrative. Now, we have our theories, but we also have lots of stories that we tell each other. And since the beginning of time, recorded time, we have told each other stories about the past, the present, and the future. And these stories have inspired and informed us. And we call a lot of them from early on myths. And they were cosmic, they were transcendent, but they were stories. So they emotionally engaged us. Now, in our present day, we still have stories. And what science fiction I see as is it's contemporary informed or scientifically informed modern myths that are stories that are informing and inspiring us and warning us. And there's no way around the fact that people require and need those kinds of stories. So science fiction can warn us, it can inform us, it can inspire us, but the idea that myth is something from the past and we still don't have them. We do still have them. They're just in science fiction clothing now because they're a different ontology than the myths of the past. They're critical, absolutely critical. And you could have myths that science fiction myths that are opposite ends of the continuum. You could have the enthusiastic stories and you could have the frightening. You could have the unnerving and you could have the meditative kind of stories. All of that's part of the whole stew of human consciousness. So it's critically important. And there's no denying that we don't have them. We still have them. Now we got negative ones, a lot of them, a lot of negative scenarios that we paint of the future. And so that's informing us and depressing us at the time.
These stories that are actually myths are the ones that get picked up and given and may become culturally significant. And of course, early myths would be, it would have a religious character, and they might be stories that helped explain basic facts of the world, like where did the earth come from would be, you know, a myth that you would have. But yes. Today, when we talk about myths, especially in the milieu that I'm in with the Zero Books and all, you might think of myths as running alongside or being similar to ideologies. Myths are just so stories. Myths are stories that block you from critical understanding, right? Oh. Right. The myth of Roland Barthes, who wrote a book called Mythologies, where he was going criticizing popular culture of his time, and exposing the hidden political conservative ideologies that were in various forms of everyday expression, like a photograph in a popular magazine, or when he would go to the wrestling match and watch the mythologies being acted out on the mat.
Yeah, right. Yes, and you got a point, Doug. But the point, the counter will be that you have different writers with different philosophical points of view and different ideologies who will write different kinds of myths that will be at odds with each other. So a myth, of course, does constrain consciousness. It does block you in a sense. But so does any scientific theory for that matter, too. It structures your way of thinking. So now you can have alternative myths, which would be critiques of the other one.
The key is not whether or not it's constraining you, but whether or not you're meant to be able to critique it or think through it.
Yeah.
Or not.
Yes, of course. Yes. And of course, because you could sit and contemplate, for example, Philip K. Dick. And what was he trying to say? What was his ideology? What was Stapleton's ideology? What was Wells' ideology? What is Stephen Baxter's ideology? What is Kim Stanley Robinson's ideology. What are his myths all about? And you could throw up counters to them, alternative myths, or you can get into a critical analysis of them. The fact, though, is you can't get around them, because we are creatures which tell stories. And what moves us, what sticks in our heads, are the stories we tell to each other. So you can't see the rationalist vision that I'm going to be able to figure the future out and guide it through a set of calculations is never going to work, because humans have this need to put it in the form of an emotionally stimulating, depressing, invigorating narrative with heroes and villains and everything else.
Well, I mean, the problem with the quantitative, strictly kind of mathematical, empirical approach to reality is that you're assuming that what's most important in the world, you're telling yourself the story about the world, that what's most important are those things which can be counted and quantified.
Yes,
and,
of course.
You know,
that's part
and
of
measured.
That's part of the mindset.
It's not always, that's often very useful, very, very useful, but it isn't always the case that that's the ultimate value. I want to ask you this question to kind of close.
Well, can I just mention one last thing about it, Doug? I would recommend on that point that the viewer go read Ziamatin's We, which is a great both critique and questioning of the notion that everything in reality, including humanity, can be understood mathematically. But the central character understands everything mathematically, including himself. So go on.
Okay, I'd like to read that.
No, that's a great novel, great early classic of science fiction.
I definitely got to go read that one. All right, so what is the myth of science fiction and the future of science fiction, and the history of science fiction that you're telling in your book?
The myth I'm telling is that humans have the capacity to consciously transcend the immediate here and now in their imagination and thinking and storytelling. And through this capacity, which includes thinking about the future, we are guiding our future evolution. And so I'm presenting a self-empowering myth saying that science fiction, among other things, is a vehicle by means of which we are evolving our minds through time.